Welcome to the Get Ready Podcast. Today we are on part 9 of our 10-part series, How to Get Prepared for a 3-Month SHTF Event. Today we're discussing how to prevent and treat injuries sustained during a bug-out journey, how to set up your retreat's clinic, and how to treat combat injuries. Our medical expert for today is Dr. Lee, an emergency medicine specialist with over 20 years of experience practicing medicine. If you've ever been to the ER, give this episode a like. Here's RB and Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Jeffries. Welcome to the Get Ready Podcast. This is RB, joined by my very special guest, Dr. Lee. JD is about as much of a doctor as Joe Biden is, so I had to reach out to my good friend, Dr. Lee, because he is an actual doctor, and ask him to step in and give us a rundown of what medical information we need to know to survive a 90-day SHTF event. Dr. Lee, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We've been good friends for, I don't know, how many?
Seven or so years.
Seven plus years. But the audience obviously doesn't know who you are. Would you mind giving them just a quick background about who you are, where you're from, and what your background is in medicine?
Sure. I was born in Virginia a long time ago, moved out of the state for quite some time, and then came back and have been here practicing emergency medicine for the last about 20 years in the Central Virginia area.
Awesome. Okay, we are going to split this main topic into three parts. The first is about bugging out. What's your bug out bag look like and what type of first aid kit should be in there? The second is going to be life on the retreat. How do you set up an in-home clinic and how do you treat some common injuries that are bound to happen in a post-apocalyptic world? And the third one is going to be combat injuries, actually setting up your IFAC for some serious combat action. But first, we need to heal our minds with a much-needed mindset minute.
When your brain detects fear, it triggers the release of adrenaline and cortisol into your bloodstream. If left unmanaged, chronic stress can impact nearly every system in your body, affecting everything from your digestive system to your immune response. Cortisol, in particular, temporarily hampers your ability to fend off infections and can contribute to various health issues, including arthritis, diabetes, heart disease, IBS, dementia, and even cancer. Furthermore, it can give rise to more subtle ailments such as anxiety, depression, headaches, and insomnia. Stress often arises when you feel like a situation is spiraling out of control, which is basically the definition of a SHTF event. However, if you have the assurance that your family's basic food, safety, and health are met, your stress levels will significantly decrease. So don't panic during the initial stages of SHTF. You knew this was coming. You took steps to prepare. This is your moment to step up and lead.
Seems like every month there's a new crisis that could be the big one. But if there's one thing we've learned from observing the war in Israel and the war in Ukraine and before that, the Bosnian War and the 2020 pandemic, people really don't want to bug out. I've seen videos of people in Gaza that are filming when apartments across the street are being blown up and they just won't leave. And I know Hamas is preventing people from leaving now, but everyone knew as soon as the attacks happened that Israel was going to retaliate. Many people could have left at that point. Absolutely, there was a little bit of time. And there's a great book from Selko Begovic where he wrote about how things were getting bad in Bosnia. He could have left, but he didn't. He missed his window. It was just too late for him to leave. And if even go back further to World War II, the Jews in Germany had plenty of time to leave. Actually, I think it's 1933, the Nazis first initiated a boycott of Jewish-owned businesses. And then in 1935, they stripped the Jews of their citizenship. 1938 was that night of broken glass where all those Jewish businesses and synagogues and homes were broken into. All of these happened well before World War II. The writing was on the wall, and still many Jews did not leave. All of that tells me something really important, and that is, one, people will likely have plenty of warning that SHTF is coming, and two, people will probably ignore it, and they're not going to bug out. I think this goes for preppers as well. I think 1% of the people who either live at a retreat full-time or are truly ready to bug out at a moment's of notice, they may bug out, and this section may not apply to you, but for everyone else, this is going to be a big issue. So the 99% of you listening, the 99% of people in the world who are bugging out on foot, it's probably just best to accept the fact that you're not going to want to leave, even though you know you should, and plan accordingly. So let's assume that you didn't bug out when you should have bugged out, but now you realize you absolutely have to go. You've got to do it on foot. All of that leads up to my very first question for Dr. Lee, which is, what's the biggest medical challenge for a small family that has to travel, say, 60 miles on foot to their bug out location?
I think the biggest challenge is going to be the toll it's going to take on your body. You think, 60 miles, that's not so bad. We can do it 20 miles a day for 3 days and we're there. But if you're a young family and you've got kids, you are in for a world of hurt. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, you need to figure out how you're going to get everybody there together. If you've got kids, there's no way they're going to walk 20 miles a day. When I had younger kids, I considered this. And what I ended up doing was buying one of those garden carts, a gorilla cart.
Yeah.
Which carries 1,300 pounds. So lots of supplies, but you can stack your kids on top of it if you need to. And that's a good way. You know, it's going to be extra stress on you pulling the cart or pushing the cart or both, but you're going to be able to get your kids moving along at the rate you want to go. The main stress on your body is going to be on your feet. You're going to want to really take good care of your feet. You're going to want to have shoes that are broken in well. You're going to want to have extra socks. You're going to want to switch into fresh socks as often as possible. If you're out in the rain, you're not going to want to keep your feet wet for very long. You're going to want to switch into dry socks as soon as possible. And you're going to want to stop every hour or two and check your feet carefully for any blisters and cover those up or trim off the blister as necessary. If you get a blister infected, you're going to be in a lot of trouble there, especially if you need to go 60 miles.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think, okay, I'm an adult, 20 miles, I can do it. They may not factor in a 35-pound backpack, or they're towing their kids, or whatever other supplies that they have to take with them. And all of a sudden, that 20 miles really drops down, and they don't feel the effect on their body for multiple day hiking. Do you think that damage to the body compounds the longer that bug out trip goes on?
I absolutely think it's going to compound. You're going to be hurting so bad after the first day, you're not going to know how you're going to make the next couple of days, probably. People who go out and walk for exercise, they'll go walk 3 to 5 miles and feel pretty tired, pretty satisfied after that. But if you need to walk all day for multiple days in a row, you're going to be feeling it. I highly recommend you pre-treat yourself with some ibuprofen, also known as Motrin. Carry lots of that with you for you, the kids, the wife, everyone, to keep your aches and pains under control. I think the other big thing that you need to think about is temperature regulation. Now, of course, SHTF isn't going to happen when the weather is beautiful and it's 70 degrees outside. It's probably going to be in the dead of winter or the middle of the summer heat, which is pretty nasty here in Central Virginia. So you're going to want to think about sun protection, sunscreen, cold protection in the wintertime, keeping your feet warm and dry, keeping the rest of you warm and dry, and especially bundling up the kids so they don't freeze to death.
You mentioned a couple of things that I think would be in a first aid kit. For example, you mentioned Motrin. You've got some pads for blisters. What other type of items would you consider critical for a first aid kit for a family of four bugging out?
Critical would be anything to make you more comfortable, like Motrin, Tylenol, those type of things. You need to worry about allergic reactions, so Benadryl, highly recommended. Also, if your kids sleep well with Benadryl or you sleep well with Benadryl, that might be something you want to consider to take. Pepcid is technically a stomach medicine, but that can help with itching. It's also a histamine blocker, like the Benadryl is. If you need an EpiPen for severe allergic reactions, you're really going to want to carry that. Excedrin, I highly recommend for headaches. And you're also going to want to have some type of antibacterial soap and some way to rinse out wounds that you're pretty much guaranteed to get along the way.
What about abrasions, moleskin or bandages? How important are those guys?
There is a whole multitude of blister care products out there right now. I can't even keep up on all of them, but the best ones that I've seen and the ones that I carry are kind of like a little Band-Aid with some gel kind of overlying the blister that you can just put on that. I highly recommend that you carry some alcohol prep pads to clean off the area and let these stick really good, because if you've got sweaty, wet, dirty feet, you want to clean that area good so these things actually stick over top of the blister.
You made me think about common medication that your family would use on a day-to-day basis. For example, my wife has migraines, so we should probably keep a couple of the migraine medication in the first aid kit. Perhaps anxiety. If you struggle with some anxiety issues, you're probably going to be pretty anxious. maybe having some anxiety medication would be good. Or if you're on a blood thinner, maybe whatever your daily medication is, probably have some of that in the kit as well.
Absolutely. Anything that you normally take, you should hopefully have a backstock of that so you can carry a bunch of that with you to your bug out location. But definitely bring all that along with you, because if you don't have a stock of it already at your bug out location, you're going to need to bring all that you're going to need. And that's all that you're going to have for the foreseeable future.
Great point. I actually didn't even think about pre-positioning medication that people in my group need at the retreat ahead of time. That should really be on our group minimum list.
Yeah, if your doctor is willing to write you some prescriptions ahead of time so you can stock up on, say, blood pressure medicine or anxiety medicine or any of that stuff that you need, like for migraines, if you could have that at your bug out location, that would be ideal, because you never know what's going to happen on your trip. You could lose everything on the way.
Yep. Let's talk a little bit about the logistics of that bug out and the first aid kit. What are your thoughts about having one dedicated person carrying the weight of that first aid kit versus having multiple people in your group each having their own individual first aid kit?
I think one first aid kit is perfect. If you're going to be traveling as a group, you're going to be staying together, and you should have that available for everyone. Just think ahead of time of any needs you might have along the way, any things you might need for small kids. Another thing you might consider is some kind of rehydration fluids. You don't need to carry the fluids themselves, but Pedialyte, Liquid IV, they make these little powder packs that you can just dump into a water bottle and hydrate yourself and your kids along the way if necessary.
Great points. Now, if you're on a bug out journey, you're obviously going to want to make the best time as possible. What are some warning signs that you may be pushing your family too hard or pushing yourself too hard and that you really want to watch out for, that you have to pull back, take a rest? What are some of the physical signs that you need to keep an eye out for?
I think the main thing is going to be your feet. If your feet are getting battered and you're getting blisters all over the place, you really need to stop, take care of those, make sure your feet are in good shape. Otherwise, everyone's going to have aches and pains, and the faster you get to your bug out location, the better.
Okay, you mentioned before about pre-medicating with some Motrin. What are some other things that you should be thinking ahead of time, maybe the night before, that you want to be doing to help your body handle that stressful journey?
Lots of rest, lots of hydration. Make sure you're drinking a ton. Make sure your kids are keeping up on their fluids. And being the head of household, you're probably going to be more nervous, more anxious than anybody else. You need to make sure you're taking care of yourself, so far as hydrating, making sure you're eating enough, and taking care of yourself so you can take care of others.
What do you think about electrolytes versus Gatorade and maybe some homemade stuff?
I think Gatorade is okay. Some of the sports drinks are okay. I think the best thing is Pedialyte or Liquid IV. Those really rehydrate you. They've got some salt, they've got some sugar, they've got some electrolytes, and you really need the salt and the sugar together to carry the water across the intestines to rehydrate you better than just the Gatorade. Gatorade will work fine, but if you're having some diarrhea, that tends to make your diarrhea worse because it's got a lot of sugar in it, and it doesn't absorb as easily as the Pedialyte or Liquid IV.
Just thinking of diarrhea on a bug out journey would be the worst possible scenario in my mind. What about other signs of your body that maybe you're not dealing with heat well enough, or fatigue or stress? What are some things you can watch out for yourself or for your wife, for example?
Yeah, I think it's important to keep a close eye on everyone for signs of heat stress. If they seem to be getting a little confused, if they're just not acting right, if you're feeling a little confused or not quite acting right, if somebody says, hey, what's wrong with you? You really need to take it easy, sit in some shade. Maybe during the summer, you might consider bugging out during the night and traveling at night. I think during the first few days, it's probably going to be safe enough to travel at night. After the first week or so, I would worry about people taking advantage of travelers out there.
Mm-hmm. I know America is hooked on coffee, right? Everyone is addicted to coffee and caffeine a little bit too much. But what are your thoughts on bringing some extra stimulants with you, like coffee, energy drinks, maybe caffeine pills, as part of your bug out plan?
I think it's a great idea. I carry caffeine gum in my emergency first aid kit that I have. And I think that's a great way to get the caffeine, but any way you get it is fine. As far as kids go, a little chocolate that's got some caffeine in it. The sugar's not going to hurt them either. Anything you can do to energize kids and yourself along the journey is going to be great.
Yeah, you talked about traveling at night. Do you think it's safer to travel during the day when you can see your surroundings, see danger, use your binoculars a little bit better? Or Do you think it's better to travel at night where there might be fewer people, but you don't have as good a grasp of the dangers around you? You could be tripping over logs, twisting your ankles. What are some of the pros and cons you think about with traveling during day and night?
I think traveling during the night would be ideal if you're traveling along a road or a well-traveled path. If you're going through the woods, I think you might as well just hang it up at night and take a rest. You're more likely to trip, break an ankle, sprain an ankle, hurt something else, and that's going to be not ideal for getting to where you want to go. The gorilla cart that I recommended, if you're traveling through the woods, you're not going to have a chance to use that unless you're on some wide fire trail or something like that. During the day, I just worry about visibility. Here you are traveling with as many belongings as you can carry. You're going to look like a pretty good target for people.
I was doing a very simple hike with my group a couple weeks back through the woods, just around the property. And we were out there for maybe half an hour. We walked away with so many injuries. I got a spider bite. We didn't have gloves. We didn't have glasses. But it just really made me think, you really need to be protected if you're walking through the woods. There's so many things out there that can injure you. You can really hurt yourself. And you're moving much slower. So that 20 miles a day, that is not through the woods. That's on a highway. What do you think about some of the dangers just to your body as you're walking through the woods?
The glasses is an excellent point. If you're going to be walking through the woods, even during the day, consider wearing some clear glasses just to keep from getting poked in the eye by a branch.
Yeah, you don't want to lose an eye on a bug out journey. And you also made me think about the heat piece of it. Maybe wearing a hat with a brim, keep you cool a little bit longer. Maybe one of those cloths that you wipe around your neck might help regulate your body temperature. There's probably a number of things with your clothing that you could do in order to make your journey a little bit more comfortable in the woods and on the highway.
Yeah, those are great ideas. I actually have an umbrella I bought specially for bugging out just in case. Ah. And it's a silver reflective umbrella to reflect the heat off of me.
That's very cool. Last year, just a quick story. Last year, I was stepping out of my storage shed unit and I rolled my ankle. I didn't realize it at the time, but I believe I actually fractured it. It was black and blue, and I couldn't walk for a couple days, and it took months to actually heal to the point where I could move without feeling it in every step. It wouldn't surprise me at all if I was walking through the woods and I rolled my ankle again on some sort of log. What is your recommended approach if, for that family that's bugging out, one of them injures their foot or their leg and can't be mobile?
I'd actually recommend carrying some crutches with you. I know that sounds like a big burden to carry with you, but you can buy crutches super cheap off of Amazon. Adjustable crutches, you can adjust them for just about any height, almost down to kid size. But if you twist your ankle, break your ankle, even a bad sprain, you can't walk on it. You're either riding on a cart if you've got it or riding on somebody's back, and that's not going to be very enjoyable for the person carrying you. I recommend ACE wraps both for support and to prevent some of the swelling that'll come along with a twisted ankle. As soon as you twist that ankle, put that ACE wrap on there to give it extra support and to prevent some of the swelling you're going to get along with that.
What do you think about building your own crutches out of some sticks? Maybe wrapping a towel around the top of it for a cushion?
If that's all you got, that would be great. Make sure you've got the cutting tools so you can make that a saw, a good axe, a knife, whatever you need. You could certainly do that, but ideally you'd have your own crutches or a garden cart or something you can pile somebody on and just pull them along for the rest of the journey.
What about a stretcher you could make out of the woods and drag them along if you didn't have a garden cart?
Yeah, you could always fashion a stretcher. That would be a challenge to pull. That would be quite a bit. If you're just a small family and say your wife twists her ankle and then it's up to you to pull her along on that and some kind of garden cart or carry a big pack that you've got, that's probably not going to work out so well.
I just imagine me dragging my wife down the highway on a stretcher, just grinding behind it. I don't think she'd be keen about that. All right. Although walking sticks are probably a pretty good idea. Like right when you set out, if you have to go through the woods or even on the highway, two walking poles maybe stabilize you, reduce your risk of twisting your ankle.
Walking poles would not be a bad idea.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the nicest times of years in Virginia, where we're at. But most of the time, it's super hot and humid, or it's cold and wet. One of those two tends to be our current temperatures. What are some of the precautions you can think about taking on your bug out if you're in record heat or if you're in the dead of winter? Because obviously, that's going to change your bug out bag, maybe your bug out journey. But what are some things you can plan ahead for those extreme weathers?
I think you really need to plan ahead. Think about what clothes you might need for bugging out. You can layer up pretty good for wintertime. Summertime is going to probably be the biggest challenge because you just can't get away from that heat during the day.
Yeah.
Again, if you can travel at night, if you're traveling along a road, if it's a moonlit night, that should work out pretty well. But of course, it's not going to be that for you when you need to bug out.
Yeah. Okay, I think we covered bugging out pretty well.
Let's recap. On a bug out, your feet are your top priority. Check for blisters every 2 hours, bring plenty of pairs of fresh socks, and use Lookatape to prevent hot spots from becoming blisters. The night before your journey, start drinking extra water, eat a solid meal, and get as much sleep as you can. Before you leave, pre-medicate with Tylenol and Motrin. Use an electrolyte drink to stay hydrated. Watch for signs of heat stress like dizziness, confusion, headache, muscle cramps, nausea, or vomiting. If in winter, wear proper layers. If in summer, travel at night. When in the woods, wear eye protection and high-laced hiking boots to prevent sprained ankles. Critical items your first aid kit should have: Tylenol or Motrin for pain, Benadryl for allergic reactions, Pepcid for your stomach, Excedrin for headaches, antibacterial soap to rinse wounds, alcohol prep pads, Band-Aids, and an ACE wrap. Next Monday, we'll be covering an expanded list of first aid kit items when we go deep on items we'll need getting home, bugging out, and falling back. Make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss next Monday's episode.
Let's play a card game called Are You Ready for RAW, World Without Rule of Law. Jeffries is going to read us a scenario, and I'll let you answer first, and then I'll share some of my own thoughts. Just keep in mind, and this is the key, that it's not about the scenario, it's just about your way of thinking.
In 2026, a highly contagious and deadly pandemic hits New York City, causing widespread panic and economic devastation. As a nurse working in a hospital that has run out of personal protective equipment, PPE, you have the option to quit and save yourself or stay and risk your life to save others. What do you do?
That's an interesting one. I'll say right up front, nurses are much more practical and much smarter than doctors are. If they ran out of protective equipment, I don't think the nurses would be around because they want to protect their family. They don't want to take anything home to their family. And the doctors are the same. We don't want to take anything home to our family that's going to actually wipe them out. I think that if protective equipment ran out, nurses would stop showing up to the hospital. And without nurses, doctors can't do anything. We can't access medicines in the hospital. We don't know how to run things. We just know how to take care of the patients. Everything else, all the important stuff, is done by nurses. There wouldn't even be any sense for the doctors to show up because we wouldn't be able to get anything done. I think people don't realize how close we came to the edge with COVID when it was really bad. In the beginning, when everyone was getting so sick, especially the old people, we were right on the edge of running out of space. And that's not even really a very deadly pandemic that we just went through. The few percentage of people that were dying is pretty low compared to some of the historic pandemics that we've had in the past. When and if we run out of space with a more deadly pandemic, things are just going to become so bogged down, so clogged up with patients, the ER will quickly fill up with super sick patients, and then nobody else will be able to be seen. Nobody else will be able to be admitted to the hospital. There'll be no room for them. There'll be no room in the ER for anybody. It'll pretty much be good luck, take care of your family, do the best you can, but we don't have any space for you here.
You, as a nurse, would follow your own advice and say, hey, it's too much of a risk to my family. If I don't have the proper protective equipment, then I'm not going to show up.
Yes, I would say that would probably be what would happen. We really didn't even have proper protective equipment during this last pandemic. We were reusing single-use masks. We were sterilizing things to use over and over again. It was really right on the edge.
I have the same response. I mean, I've... not going to sacrifice myself for other people when my family needs me at home. So I feel bad for saying that, but that's just the reality of it. It's not even real a hard question for me. I'm definitely leaving. I might even leave before the personal protective equipment runs out. I just might not show up for work pretty quickly. That's me. All right, so let's talk about setting up a retreat. I've been truly wanting to set up a legit SHTF clinic at my retreat for years. I just have no idea what I'm doing, so I haven't. But one of the things that inspired me was really two popular TV shows. One was The Walking Dead, and the other was Jericho. Both of these shows, they've got scenes, I can imagine it in my mind right now, where somebody gets shot on each show, and they drag them in the farmhouse and clear off the kitchen table, and it's immediate gunshot wound surgery right there in the kitchen. And I think that's very possible. It's probably going to happen more than we think in a true SHTF situation. But there's got to be a better way of treating a gunshot wound than on your kitchen table with a rusty steak knife, right? So let's talk a little bit about if you were to set up a true, legitimate clinic in a practical way, on a prepper's budget, something in your house or maybe in an outbuilding, I want to know the details of what that clinic looks like. A couple of questions I have is, how much space do you need? Is this something where I could convert a room or an office in my house to a medical area? Or should I be buying a dedicated shed and have the clinic ready to go in the shed? What do you think?
I think ideally you'd have it separate from your house. One of the big things you're going to need to worry about, at least early in any SHTF event, is infectious disease. If you've got people come into your bug out location and they seem sick, you're going to want to quarantine them away from everybody else, because the last thing you want is everyone to get the flu or everyone to get the new pandemic or whatever might be going around. So ideally you have limited contact with them. You have them at a separate location so they're not in the house with everybody else. And I think it's probably smart to quarantine people when they first come to a bug out location anyway, especially if the rest of you have been there for a while and they come in, say, 2 weeks, a month later, just managing to get there finally. I think you're going to want to quarantine them just to make sure they don't have anything that they're going to spread around. Ideal space would probably be, maybe 2 beds, 2 exam tables, whatever you want to call them. I think the TV shows make it look really exciting, digging bullets out of people and doing all kinds of surgeries. But honestly, number one, don't dig bullets out of people. Your body will seal that bullet off. Unless it's pressing on your spinal cord or something along those lines, just leave the bullet where it is. I don't know why they always show people digging bullets out of people. You're going to do way more damage trying to get that out of somebody than just leaving it in place. If it's pressing on your spinal cord, you're out of luck anyway. I don't know any spinal surgeons who are preparing for SHTF. Equipment that you're going to want to have is going to be the basic stuff. You're really, any kind of medical stuff you're going to be doing at your bug out location is going to be mostly basics. Anything you need for wound care, you're going to want to have lots of gauze. You're going to want to have irrigation solution. You're going to want to have some antibacterial or antimicrobial soap, because that's mostly what you're going to be doing, is taking care of the small things. And I would say on that point, any injury that anybody gets during the day, they stop work immediately. You get that thing cleaned out. You get it bandaged up as much as you need to, even a scrape, because infection is going to kill you. It's easy enough now. You get a little infection, a little skin infection, a little cellulitis. You go to the ER, you get some antibiotics, and you live happily ever after. If you don't have antibiotics in the future, you're going to be out of luck if you get an infection. Basically, it's probably going to kill you. You're going to get sepsis, and you're going to die. So any injury, even minor, while you're out there doing work, needs to be taken care of immediately.
I think there's a mindset shift that needs to happen as soon as SHTF hits. And the medical professional at the retreat has got to reinforce that mindset, which is the dangerous things that you could get away with pre-SHTF, you can't do anymore. I was standing on a fuel tank messing around with something the other day, and I was thinking to myself, if this were SHTF, it would be a very bad idea. I should probably have another person helping me with this. But I'm like, whatever, it's fine. But that sort of dangerous mentality, using chainsaws, using axes, all of that stuff, you have to be so much more precautious than you would in a pre-SHTF situation. And I think that medical professional needs to lead with the mindset aspect of it and educate and motivate people to be more precautious.
Absolutely. Every injury is a big deal. Every injury is a huge deal. It's easy enough for even small things to get infected, and I see it in the ER all the time. But again, you throw some antibiotics at them, they're great. They have no problem. They probably don't even finish all the antibiotics I gave them. But with SHTF, you're going to want to have some kind of antimicrobial soap to clean off the area. You don't need any special irrigating solution. Just plain clean water will work better than anything. In fact, the best thing is just, say, a liter or so bottle of water with a regular cap on it with a very small hole in it that you can just squirt into a wound and irrigate out the wound. And you want to use like the whole liter of water to clean out even a small laceration. It won't be that comfortable for the person getting irrigated, but you want to wash out all the bacteria, dirt, etc. that you can. Then clean that with the antimicrobial soap, Hibiclens or something like that that you can buy over the counter at any drugstore. Clean that out real good and then apply some antibiotic ointment and then bandage it up. There's no special antibiotic ointment that I recommend. Neosporin, bacitracin, any generic form of that is just fine. And then you want to cover it to keep it clean, but you don't want to trap moisture next to the skin. You don't want one of those waterproof bandages over it unless you're going in the water for a short time. You don't want to trap sweat next to that. You want to have it open so it can breathe a bit, and you want to keep it kind of goopy with the antibiotic ointment until it heals completely.
Love that. What about the main features, the main items that are in this clinical area? You said beds. I'm imagining lighting is going to be a big piece of it too. Are there any sort of furniture items that you use on a day-to-day basis that should be important?
Not really. I think mostly it's going to be, again, the basics type of stuff. You want some kind of bed or exam table where if you're cleaning a wound, you can have them bleed all over it. You can irrigate all over top of it. Some kind of plastic covering or something on this so you're not ruining a beautiful mattress or something like that and making your wife mad. A chair would be useful because sometimes some procedures you might want to do will require the person sitting in a chair. But yeah, beyond the basics, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do at your retreat. It seems like there's a lot more that you can do on television than you can do in actual real life.
How's about the actual tools that you're going to need? I know you mentioned a couple items that would be useful, but I'm thinking like bone saws, biting sticks, towels. Like, what are the things that you're going to really need to buy ahead of time when the doctor arrives and they're like, oh, you have such and such. Yeah, it's right here.
You're going to need tools for suturing. There are pretty simple kits that you can use for that. And those can be cleaned and sterilized good enough. Suturing is not a sterile procedure. It's a clean procedure. You don't want to have excess dirt around, but it's not something that you need to worry about sterility. Other tools, maybe a bone saw if somebody's really unfortunate, but if you've gotten to the point where you're amputating a limb, honestly, they're probably going to get infected and they're probably going to die from that unless you've got some really high-powered IV antibiotics available.
What about gloves and personal protective equipment?
Yeah, if you're dealing with people who are coming into your retreat and they've got some type of infectious disease, you're really going to want to make sure you're gloving up, wearing a mask so you're not getting whatever they have. You would want to limit the exposure of other people to these people. Other basic tools, splinter tweezers would be ideal to have because a lot of people are going to get splinters, whether it be cutting wood or building something. That's something you need to consider. Just think of the basic type of stuff that you might need for caring for basic wounds around the house.
And how about medicine? I know you touched on a few things, but what do I want to stock up in a little cabinet within the clinic in terms of antibiotics or bandages or topical treatments? What's the most important thing to have the most of?
Antibiotics would be ideal if you can get hold of them, if you know a doctor that can get some or you have some that you've saved up over time. I'll actually put on Telegram a list of my recommended antibiotics. I would say doxycycline would be my number one antibiotic that can treat skin infections. It can treat pneumonia. It can treat a variety of things. Augmentin is another great antibiotic that can treat kind of intestinal type infections. Again, if it's a bad infection, unfortunately, you're probably going to die. There's no way somebody's going to be able to operate on you and take out your appendix. But some infections can be treated with antibiotics. And if you're extremely lucky and you get appendicitis, maybe a course of antibiotics might cool it down and let you survive, although that's doubtful.
How about fish antibiotics? I don't know if you can still get them today, but that was a big thing in the prepper world for a long time. What are your thoughts?
As far as I know, fish antibiotics were made by the same manufacturers that make people antibiotics. And I never stocked up on any myself because I have access to some antibiotics on my own. But I think that's a great idea. It's certainly better than nothing. And if you've got it, keep it. Again, I'll make a list of antibiotics that I recommend on Telegram for you to take a look at.
Check out our Telegram, t.me/getreadypodcast. Amazing content being shared there every single day. I know when we think of post-apocalyptic movies and television, the sensationalization of gunshot wounds and diseases are everywhere. But what do you think the most common injuries at a retreat will be?
I think it'll be injuries from doing things you're not used to, unless you're super prepper like you. A lot of people aren't used to using chainsaws or building things or splitting wood or using an axe or even just carrying heavy objects around. There's going to be back strains. There's going to be injuries, lacerations, abrasions, sprains, those type of things. I think that's by far what you're going to be treating as far as medical stuff. You think about what goes on at your house, the type of injuries you see, the type of things your kids injure. That's what you're going to be seeing a lot of. And again, unfortunately, if you get a bad illness, if you have a heart attack, if you have a stroke, if you get appendicitis, you're probably not going to be able to treat that. And it's going to be make the person comfortable and hope they recover from whatever they've got.
Yeah, talking about making the person comfortable, painkillers are obviously going to be part of what you should have plenty of. And I know it's probably a bit controversial when we're talking about the really strong stuff because all of the opiate addictions that are happening these days, but pain management is definitely an important part of helping people to feel comfortable. Is there anything you know of that preppers could stock up ahead of time in terms of pain management, drugs, or medicine where folks can get it, stock it up, even though there are restrictions?
If you've had an injury in the past and your doctor has prescribed you hydrocodone, also known as Lortab, or oxycodone, also known as Percocet. Save some of those if you've got them left over. Medicines don't expire as fast as they want you to think they expire. They're good for years, generally, after the supposed expiration date. I can't speak highly enough of ibuprofen, Motrin, as a pain reliever. Taking high doses of it, 600, 800 milligrams for adults for pain, along with Tylenol, that works pretty good at most of the painful things that we deal with. Now, post-surgical patients and those type of things, they need the higher dose of pain medications. But unfortunately, those just aren't going to be available.
Yeah. What do you think the common doctor would say if a patient came into them and said, "Hey, doc, I'm a prepper. I'm concerned about things that are happening in the world. I'd like to have a little bit of additional pain medication on hand." What do you think the typical doctor's response to that is going to be?
I think the typical doctor is going to be a little suspicious. We have so many people who are drug seeking now in the emergency department, unfortunately, and at primary care doctor's offices also. That's going to be a tough sell to your doctor. Maybe if you've known them for a long time, you might have better luck, but I would say probably you're out of luck.
That's a no-go. What if you slip him a 50, 100? Kind of grease that a little bit. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about who your medical dream team would be. You mentioned doctors are useless without nurses in a hospital setting. What about in a retreat clinical setting? If you could pick the best skill set for your medical team in a practical way, what sort of combination of skill sets do you think would be best?
I think if you could only have one, sad for the emergency medicine guys out there, but I think I'd pick a veterinarian.
Really?
Yeah, veterinarians, they not only can they care for your animals, but they do everything.
Wow.
You know, they know wound care, they know suturing, they know splinting, they know minor surgeries, they know how to pull teeth, they do it all. Second, I guess if you could only have one person, tied for second would be either a good family medicine doctor who's been through a residency that includes OB stuff, birthing babies.
Yeah.
They have a broad range of knowledge, as do the emergency medicine folks. That's another thing I really didn't mention before is considering having a baby born on your retreat because people are not going to stop getting pregnant. People may be pregnant when SHTF. That's something you need to consider and have just a basic OB kit, just a little bulb suction to suction out the baby's mouth and nose when they come out. Something to tie off the umbilical cord. That's not a big deal. If the delivery goes smooth, it goes smooth. It's a natural part of life and they come out pretty easy when they come out pretty easy. But if things get hung up and you need a little extra knowledge, it's nice to have the family medicine or the emergency medicine person there with some extra maneuvers that they can try to get the baby out.
How about dentists?
A dentist would be fantastic. I wouldn't be my number one choice if there's only one person there because they can take care of your mouth and that's about it. But if you could have a dentist in addition to another doctor, oh, that would be invaluable.
Veterinarians, you mentioned, they have so many drugs in their shop and in their vehicles. That alone, I think, would be a huge value proposition. Okay, so you put together a couple of your key skill sets, but if you don't have any of those medical professionals and you're just an average prepper like myself, what sort of medical training do you think should be on my list of things that I need to have in order just to be competent to take care of some basic medical things?
I don't know if training is absolutely necessary, but I think knowledge is necessary. I think you could pick up the knowledge that you need by just getting a basic EMT book and just reading it through. You really need to know bleeding control. You need to know wound care. You need to know splinting, the basic stuff, and then you can expand on that. There are a ton of medical books out there. Some of the standard emergency medicine books are called Rosen's Emergency Medicine or Tentanoli Emergency Medicine. Neither of those are cheap, but they have a whole bunch of knowledge that would be really useful for you. You don't necessarily have to have a lot of medical knowledge to understand, you know, what they're saying. If you get a medical procedures book that would show you how to, say, reduce a dislocated shoulder or dislocated elbow or things of that nature, that would be really helpful for you. And again, I don't think you need specific training. I think it's just the knowledge that you need. And with YouTube out there right now and with the books available, you can get anything you need on YouTube. Of course, if SHTF comes around and the internet goes down, you're out of luck there.
So what I'm hearing is I don't need any actual medical skills. I just need to watch some YouTube videos and I'm good to go.
There is nothing you can't learn on YouTube.
Check. Great. All right. Let's flip it around. If you were putting together a survival group and you were considering a family and this family had medical condition X that you knew they wouldn't survive or they couldn't be able to help contribute to the group, what sort of medical conditions spring to mind for you that you would say, oh, this person probably wouldn't be a productive member of my prepping team?
Now you get into the moral questions.
Yeah.
I don't know that everyone in a group is going to be able to participate in everything or give what might be considered valuable work to the group, but there's always something that they can do. I don't think there's anything that would make me say, you absolutely can't join our group because of some medical issue. There's always something that they can do to help out in some way. And for these maybe complicated medical issues that they have, they're just going to have to realize that we don't really have anything to offer as far as advanced medications or advanced procedures for these things, but that we accept them as part of the group and we'll let them do what they can do.
I feel like a monster now because I'm like immediately diabetes, probably not a great thing. And then mental health issues, like psychological things. If you're on drugs for some like antipsychotic stuff, I'm like, I don't think so.
Yeah, there are a huge amount of people who are on antipsychotics, antidepressives, etc. I'm of the mind that a lot of these people don't really need these medications. I think the problem in their life is their life, and I don't think the medicines are really hurting them or helping them, that without them, they'll be able to function just fine. Give them a purpose in life. Hey, chop up that tree over there and split it into firewood. Maybe that will help them more than the medications would. The people who are dangerous, though, will be some of the schizophrenic, bipolar type of people who really depend on these medicines to maintain a normal life. It's hard to say what people will be like without their medication. Some people might be just fine, but some people may get to the point where they're dangerous. If they're hallucinating, if they believe somebody's out to get them, you're going to have to make a tough decision about what to do with those people.
Yeah, well said.
It's been 60 days since a devastating cyber attack has taken down the grid. Your small group has lost a few men to attacks and badly needs to boost their security force. Your group gets a message that a family with a father, mother, two teenage sons, and a little girl is looking for shelter. The men would make a good addition to your security force, but the little girl is clearly sick. What does your medical evaluation look like, and how would you go about quarantining them?
Medical evaluation would be just a basic physical. Again, if someone seems sick, limit the exposure to the rest of your group. Maybe your medical person is the only person that goes in and sees this person. Actually, examining them outdoors might be a benefit so they're not breathing all over you. You've got some fresh air around you to help keep whatever they've got from getting to you. Most contagious illnesses that we see these days, people are either going to get over it or they're going to die from it. in the case of a little kid, it's probably going to be something as simple as the flu or COVID or something along those lines, and they'll probably recover just fine. In the unfortunate event they don't recover, well, they're going to die, and then that's not going to be an issue for your group. As far as quarantining, I would separate them from the rest of the group for, I would say, a minimum of 5 to 10 days. Within 5 days or so, you should know if they've got some kind of illness that they're going to come down with. They should be showing signs by then, and then slowly integrate them into your group. I don't think you're going to be able to do in-depth tests on them to see if they have tuberculosis or something crazy like that. Although most people in the U.S. aren't going to be carrying around a contagious disease like that. It's going to be more along the lines of a cough, cold, flu, COVID, that type of thing.
If you have a contagious person and they're quarantined and they're clearly sick and need medical treatment, do you take them into your clinic and quarantine your whole clinic? If you do, then no one else can get any medical aid. Or do you have a quarantine clinic specifically for people that can't be in the main clinic?
That's a good question. You really would ideally have a separate place where they could quarantine rather than your medical clinic. Although you could shut down the clinic for that quarantined person and treat injuries, sprains, strains, back pain, lacerations, abrasions, you could treat those somewhere else. You could treat them on your front porch.
Okay, so this next segment is one we did a little bit ago. It's called True or False. It's where I describe an episode of National Geographic's Doomsday Preppers, and you will guess whether it is a real episode or whether or not I just made it up.
Uh-oh.
Scenario one. In this episode of Doomsday Preppers, this prepper butchered a goat and used the strands of its intestines to demonstrate how to suture a wound on a pig leg. True or false?
I feel like anything you say could have been on one of those episodes. I would say this is true.
This is false.
Oh. Thank God.
I'll tell you why it sounds true is because I did a little research on the history of suturing, and they did indeed use, I think, sheep intestines as an early way of suturing a wound closed.
Yes. I would highly recommend buying some suture material, though, and not doing that.
That's probably great. All right, number two. This episode of Doomsday Preppers featured a prepper who is shooting guns in the desert and accidentally shot his thumb off while the crew was filming. True or false?
I'm going to go with false on that one.
This is true.
Oh. Of course it is.
Yeah, and to be fair, he didn't blow it completely off. I think it was hanging on by a thread, but he clearly blew the middle of his thumb between the two joints out. Fainted, they took him to a hospital, they did reattach it, but now he's missing like a big chunk of his thumb.
Yeah.
True story.
Oh, ouch.
Brutal. How embarrassing, right?
Yes.
You're on Doomsday Preppers trying to be all legit, and all of a sudden you blow your hand off. Okay, in this episode of Doomsday Preppers, there were two preppers in a deer stand hunting coyote. Even though both of them were wearing hearing protection, the sound from one of their rifle blasts caused a concussive blast that led to dizziness, nausea, vomiting, and temporary loss of hearing. True or false?
I'm going to say false.
Final answer?
Yes.
This is true.
Oh, what a loser I am.
This guy was the biggest baby in the whole world. He actually kicked his friend out of the prepping group, made him go home because he was so injured by being next to his rifle as it went off.
I've been around some concussive blasts. I've never had that before.
No, he legit vomited on the show.
I got to get one right.
Yeah, okay, we'll see. In this episode of Doomsday Preppers, this prepper attempted to make bulletproof armor plates out of a plastic bag filled with non-Newtonian fluid and duct tape. True or false?
True.
False. No, I just clearly made that. But the reason I made that up is because I always thought, wouldn't it be cool to have non-Newtonian fluid, which is cornstarch and water, make plates out of that?
Well, these guys are also crazy. Any of these could be true.
I know. But the thing is with non-Newtonian fluid is it will harden when you impact it, but it's not going to stop a bullet.
I didn't think it would stop the bullet, but I thought he'd probably try it.
Yeah. In this episode of Doomsday Preppers, the prepper demonstrated how to perform a direct blood transfusion by successfully transferring a small amount of blood from one live sheep to another live sheep. True or false?
Oh, man. I mean, this is definitely something that can be done. Did he try it? Let's see. I will say true.
This is false.
Oh, my God. JD makes me look like an idiot.
This is false. This is, again, something that I just made up because I have sheep, and I thought, man, that would be cool to do that. But tell us a little bit about what are the risks of doing a direct blood transfusion?
Oh, more than I can think of. It's not knowing the certain antibodies in your blood versus another person's blood, and how many people even know their blood type. A lot of us aware people know our blood types, but I would say risk of infection, risk of all kinds of problems from a transfusion like that make it not worthwhile.
Mm.
You can get by with a very small amount of blood in your body. Mm-hmm. You'll survive. You won't feel very good, mm-hmm. but you can bleed quite a bit before you get to the point where you're going to die.
All right, last one. In this episode of Doomsday Preppers, a Jewish politician states the mass casualty terrorist attack in Pittsburgh, which consisted of dozens of Jewish people painting gunshot wounds on their bodies and running around as if they were being shot. True or false?
Oh my gosh. I'm going to have to say false. Did I miss everyone?
This is true.
Oh my God. All right, well.
That is brilliant. All right. That was fun. For me. Let's get back to medical for 90 days. We'll wrap this up with combat care.
Before we do that, let's recap. Your retreat's clinic should have at least one bed or exam table and a chair. Ideally, it would be detached from your home to avoid spread of infection, but you'll need a way to heat and cool it without electricity. Some basic tools you'll need are gauze, a way to irrigate wounds, antibacterial soap, suture material, blood pressure cuff, thermometers, gloves, masks, tweezers, and a birthing kit. Dr. Lee will share his list of recommended antibiotics with us on Telegram. You can join by going to t.me/getreadypodcast on your phone. Now let's wrap up with some combat first aid tips.
All right, your bug out trip was successful thanks to your amazing advice, Dr. Lee, and the retreat medical clinic is well stocked. However, there's one big thing that needs to be addressed. Getting wounded during SHTF outside of your retreat, meaning in combat. Let's start with the first aid kit every member of your retreat should have on their body, especially if they're on security team, the IFAC, individual first aid kit. What key items would you recommend go in an IFAC?
Mostly it's about bleeding control. So you need a tourniquet. You need at least one tourniquet. You should probably have two tourniquets. You need some gauze or some type of bandage like the Israeli bandage or something like that to place over a wound to stop the bleeding. You can do it with simply some 4x4s or 2x2s, basically just some gauze and then wrap an ACE wrap around that. And that can control bleeding. That'll control bleeding way better than you think it would. You can stop almost any bleeding with that. The other thing you're going to need is some type of chest seal. If you get a chest wound and it's open, you want to close it, but you want to have some type of chest seal that allows air to be released from the chest cavity so you don't develop what's called a tension pneumothorax, where basically you get increasing pressure in your chest on one side and it pushes over into the heart, squeezes on the heart, and then you can actually die from that. So you want to be able to release the pressure that's built up inside a chest wound.
Great. Let's look at a quick scenario. It's been 90 days since the lights went out, and your group leadership has given the green light for a scavenging mission in a nearby town. As the group's only medical expert, are you part of this expedition to be a field medic, or do you stay back at home?
I'm no sissy. I'd want to go along, but I think you really have to protect the medical person, whoever they are. But there's a benefit of having them along with the group that's going into town in case somebody gets hurt. So I think you send the medical person along, but have them stay back, maybe staged at a fallback location. So they're staying out of harm's way, hopefully, but able to help quickly if needed.
It's a great option D that you just came up with. Okay, let's take that scenario and take it a step further. And let's say one of the security team was shot in the chest in your scavenging mission. What are some of the immediate steps that the other security team should take? And also, what are his chances of survival in a well-stocked retreat clinic when you don't have your typical hospital equipment and medicine?
Yeah, so first thing, like I talked about with the IFAC, you want to have some kind of chest seal available. Chest seal being something that will go over the wound, stop air freely moving in and out because the lung won't be able to operate efficiently like that. But you do want to seal up the wound and allow extra pressure to leak out. So placing a chest seal on the front and or front and back, if the wound was a through and through type of wound, will both control bleeding and prevent the air from moving in and out impeded.
Can you just duct tape a credit card?
Anything that will seal up a chest wound will work. You just need to relieve the pressure every now and then if you don't have a specific type of chest seal that allows pressure to come out. So you could slap a piece of duct tape over top of it. If it'll stick with the blood on there, that'll work fine. You just need to release it every once in a while so some of the air can leak out in case it's a tension pneumothorax.
So leave the bullet in, cover with duct tape, good to go.
Good to go. Yeah, chest wounds are funny things. You can have what seems like a minor wound and people die from it, or you can have what seems like a major wound and people will survive just fine. You're not going to have a cardiothoracic surgeon who's going to go in there and explore all the vessels and look at everything. If they miss your heart and any of the major blood vessels in your lungs, you might be able to survive that. You're not going to feel very good, but you might be able to survive it.
Is the recommendation take your chance, good luck, or is it we could do some surgery if we need to, even without the hospital equipment?
I don't think that you can offer the type of surgery that is going to help this. You're going to really have to basically split the chest open or at least go in through one side and pull the ribs aside and take a look around. You're going to need major amounts of suction. You're going to need a way to tie off or cauterize bleeding blood vessels. It's going to be major. You'll probably kill the person with surgery if you attempt that.
And anesthesia.
And anesthesia. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. That's, yeah.
Just grab your stick.
If you've got a veterinarian who's got some good medicines with them, that might be a possibility. There are IV medicines like ketamine, things like that you can use that would knock them out. But I think the surgery is way too dangerous to even attempt.
Yeah. How about blood types? You mentioned blood types. I know what my blood type is, but I don't know what my family's individual blood types are off the top of my head. Is there any way to figure that out at the retreat after the fact? Or is that something that you just need to know ahead of the time?
There's no way I know of to do a simple test to tell what type of blood type you are. So either you know ahead of time or it's just going to be a mystery. Transfusion from one person to another works great on TV, but I don't think that's anything you'd want to attempt at your retreat. It's just too difficult.
Hmm. What about a universal donor? Could you take some of their blood in a packet, not a direct transfusion, and then put it in a person?
Yeah, theoretically you could do that, but there are always different antibodies that people have. Matching blood at the hospital is a huge time-consuming event where they do all kinds of tests on it. So I would say that's not something I would attempt.
Mm-hmm. How about basic prevention for getting shot? Any combat injuries? Anything you could recommend or think of that would help reduce the likelihood of someone getting seriously injured in a combat situation?
If you've got body armor, that's pretty ideal. Yeah, helmets, gosh, the real helmets are awful expensive. I don't even have one of those. But body armor would be recommended to protect your vital organs in your chest, at least. I think the best prevention is stay out of the way of the bullets. Don't go where there's going to be bullets and run from conflict if possible.
Yeah, train, be smart about it, avoid conflict. Okay, that wraps it up. This episode, I think, was an amazing discussion. Let's talk a little bit about mission.
Yeah, if you have a medical professional in your group, it's easy enough for them to teach everyone else what to do as far as the basics. I would say a good mission would be to learn the basics. Learn wound care, learn wound closure. It doesn't necessarily have to be knowing how to suture. Suturing is nice, but you could use strips of duct tape to close most any wound, and that'll work pretty good. I really recommend Steri-Strips. That's just like a semi-clear adhesive bandage, like the butterfly bandages of old. You can use those to close a lot of wounds. What you really need to concentrate on with that is cleaning the area around the wound so that can stick. So those alcohol prep pads come in handy for that and soap and water. But yeah, learn the basics. Learn about dislocations and how to reduce some of those. Learn wound care. Some of the advanced stuff like CPR and advanced surgical procedures I really don't think are that valuable, because if somebody needs CPR when SHTF happens, you're out of luck, unfortunately, if you get to that point. But the basics will really get you through almost everything.
Amazing. Dr. Lee, that was incredible. Thanks so much for being on the podcast. Any closing thoughts you want to leave the listeners with?
No, I think I pretty much said it all. The basics are really where it's at. What I'm going to do is put on Telegram a lot of the stuff that I mentioned. I'm going to put my recommended medications for both your family's first aid kit and a group first aid kit. What I think is valuable, what I think you need. Certainly that's variable depending on your special circumstances. If you have specialty medical problems, you need to plan for those. But I'll put everything on Telegram that I think is important from this podcast.
There it is. If you have burning questions for Dr. Lee, he's going to be kind enough to join us on Telegram and answer some of your questions, as well as sharing his lists of first aid kit and antibiotics. I almost said probiotics. It's a little different. First aid kit and antibiotics on our Telegram channel. Open your phone's browser and go to t.me/getreadypodcast. With that, Jeffriesville, see you out.
Let's close out with a little medical trivia. Most average-sized adults have between 9 and 12 pints of blood in their body. You can lose about half of the blood in your body before you would die. In 2019, a rapper called Young Baby from Trenton, New Jersey had been shot 35 times in either a robbery or killing spree, and he survived. Nearly half of all the shots were in his legs alone. He ended up making a full recovery and was in the hospital for only a total of 22 days and had been through a coma about half of the time. The average number of Americans who took medication for mental health reasons was 15.8% in 2019. That same average is now 24%. I'm going to go ahead and say that extra 8% is all Gen Z. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Get Ready Podcast. If you want a heads up the moment a new show goes live, go ahead and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. Until next time, stay safe out there.